If Within the Trenches has taught you something, opened your eyes to what it's like to be a 911 dispatcher, or has inspired you to become one, then help support us and join our Patreon. Get exclusive bonus content, one-of-a-kind swag, discounts on merchandise, and two bonus podcasts. The Within the Trenches Rebid, where we visit past guests, and Open Mic Live, a live stream show where we share funny dispatch stories. To join, please visit patreon.com/WTT podcast. And if you're an industry partner, we have something for you as well. And now for the show.
This is Jordan, and you're listening to the Code 7 Podcast Network.
Warning. This episode contains the three A's of podcasting: adult content, adult language, and awesomeness. You've been warned.
Welcome to Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them.
Hey, what's going on? This is Ricardo with the Code 7 Podcast Network, and this is going to be episode 305 of Within the Trenches, true stories from the 911 dispatchers who live them. This episode, as always, is supported by InDigital, a leader in next-gen core services, and we're recording live from the 2020 NINA Standards and Best Practices Conference, and actually, around 2 p.m. today. Today is the 23rd of January, is going to be the start of the Critical Issues Forum. And we're going to be going over mental health and wellness and all types of things. I'm very excited for that. And we're going to go ahead and jump right in with my guest. And my guest today is Nicole, and she's a training administrative supervisor with Chelsea Emergency Management and Communications. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. It's, it's actually sunny outside right now. Yesterday it was gloomy and rainy, and being in Texas, I was expecting it to be a little bit warmer.
Yes.
but you know, I shouldn't piss and moan about it because it's actually way warmer than my family is dealing with back in Indiana. When I left Indiana, it was actually negative 12, something like that.
Oh, see, I thought I had it worse. It was 20 degrees in Boston when I left. So I'm excited to come down here and see that it's like 55.
Right. It has been good. Yeah.
Excited.
That's what I was saying. You know, I can't piss and moan about it because it actually is nice. It's just, I wanted to see more of the sun, and it is out. And so it's been good.
Oh, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
From what I can see from the lobby. It's gorgeous.
Have you been out at all around, like, any sightseeing or anything?
We went out to dinner. No sightseeing yet, but I'm hoping to get just a little bit in.
Yeah.
We went out to dinner last night, and I love it. Whenever I travel, I love walking around the city at night, just to kind of explore and get the feel of it.
Of course.
And last night it was actually pretty gorgeous. It was a little drizzly, but still gorgeous night out. I mean, I can't complain. Right now at home, I would be bundled up and, and slogging through like the dirty, gross slush on the ground.
Right, exactly.
And last night just got to walk around. We went to a fantastic Mexican food restaurant. Had some amazing chicken with mole.
Oh,
Apparently, the best in Austin.
Very nice, even better.
Very, very good.
Yeah.
And then actually, I came back and went to bed because I know I have my presentation today.
That's right. Yes. And we're going
to. So adulting.
Yeah, I know, right? Ah, damn that adulting. And we're definitely going to get into that here a little bit later in the episode. But I want to learn more about you because you've got, there's a lot to your story.
Yeah.
So, to begin with, you know, how did you get into dispatching to begin with? How did you get into public safety? Did you have family in public safety, or how did it work out for you?
No, actually. So public safety was something, specifically law enforcement, was something I always had an interest in. In high school, I got to be part of the police explorers for about like 6 months.
Oh, nice.
And then my mother figured out what was up. And basically ruled, you know, well, law enforcement really isn't a proper profession for a lady. And I'm using air quotes for a lady.
Yeah.
Because I was very athletic, very much a tomboy, very much not a lady. I can't imagine that word ever really applying to me. But that's what I was told. You know, you really need to pick a profession that's more proper for a woman, especially because ultimately you're just going to be getting married and having kids. And that's your sole purpose in life. So I was kind of directed more into the social work field.
Yeah.
Did go to school for social work. But while in college, realized home life was getting to be pretty toxic. I got to the point where I felt like I could not return home. I was scared to return home. And I found out that our public safety department for college had dispatch positions available for students. In fact, the rule was the students have to be the dispatchers. And public safety never closes. They're always open,
right,
even when the school isn't. So by getting a dispatcher position with public safety, it gave me my home away from home.
Yeah.
Even during Christmas break, spring break, I had an excuse not to
have
to go home.
Like, well,
I have a job. And they provide housing for students when the school is closed, but you have a legitimate job that you have to do. So that got me my home away from home, but also it also got me into that law enforcement field that I'd been craving.
Right, exactly.
I did work in social work for a couple of years. I ended up working for Department of Children and Families. They have a child abuse hotline. So I worked there for about a year and a half, 2 years, just answering calls on child abuse. Still felt the draw to law enforcement. So I ended up going and working for a local town, took the civil service exam, got called in for Boston Police, actually, to be a recruit, and ended up failing out because my eyesight is shit.
What?
So the state standard for Massachusetts is very strict.
Yeah.
When it comes to being a cop, you get a whole booklet. Here's all of our standards you have to meet physically in order to be a cop. The state standard for eyesight is 2100 uncorrected. No glasses, no contacts, nothing. And my eye exam pretty much went like, okay, ma'am, read the fourth line down. What line?
Oh no.
And this little blue-haired lady conducting the test was looking at me like she thought I was playing a joke on her. And she's like, no, honey, just any line. And I was like, yeah, what line? So yeah, I unfortunately I'm a 2400 when it comes to my eyesight. So I failed out, and that pretty much canceled it for the entire state. Now I'm ineligible for the entire state. But at that point, I've been dispatching for about 4 years, and really figured, I actually kind of like this though. I feel like I'm good at it. It's not a bad gig. I still get to be in law enforcement. I understand the thinking, the thought process behind it all. And that's how I ended up going to Boston, was a few months after I found out, about 6 months after I found out I failed out as a recruit, they had a position open for police dispatching. And that 30-page application that they had given me to be a cop.
Oh, okay. I was like, wait. Dispatch was 30 pages?
You also have to fill out that same application.
Oh, okay.
But I had been very smart and photocopied my entire application.
Well done. Well done.
So I pretty much just took the copy and handed it right back to him. I was like, okay, fine. I want to be a police dispatcher then.
Yeah.
So got called in, passed a typing test, and that's how I got to work at Boston.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So, okay, let's rewind just a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
What was your age then when you had first started out? You're going to school, you know, they're doing the housing and everything. How old were you around that time?
I must have been about 20.
Okay.
Just 20, 21.
Wow. You know, what's interesting is a lot of people that I've talked to on this podcast have all been like range between 18 to 20 when they first started out. Some people earlier in an Explorer program or something, you know, kind of like how you were talking and stuff too. But then, so then you go, you've been in dispatching and you want to go into law enforcement. Your eyesight keeps you out. When I first started dispatching in Florida, our records keeper, her husband was a trooper there in Florida. And he kept telling me, you know, I can help you get in. You should try this. You'd be really good at it. I'm like, all right, I'll go. I go. I do all the testing. I aced it. It was good. The physical part, I wouldn't say I aced it. I made it in plenty of time in the time limit. But man, my leg cramped up when I was trying to pull the 100-pound dummy.
Yeah.
And I actually fell. I fell back and I remember my shoe flying up in the air. And I remember one of the sergeants there was, keep going, Martinez, keep going. And I'm like, ugh, pull it. So I'm running it with one shoe and limping. And I got through and I finished it. And I remember at the end, that same sergeant goes, you got a lot of heart, kid. He goes, but you need to eat more bananas. Because you need to eat more bananas and you won't cramp up like that.
Do you
that.
Think you're still a story? Did they still tell that story?
Probably. Yeah, they're like, man, there was this kid? One guy. Yeah, this one guy. He didn't have enough bananas. His leg gave out. He cramped up and fell
it's
over.
It's funny how those things happen, though.
Yeah, but you know what kept me out of all that? Because I did the written, I did everything. And what kept me out was my credit score.
Oh.
I was a few points off on what they needed for a good credit score. And I said, how is that anything? And they said, well, we look at that as being responsible for one. And two, you know, you might need the money. You might take bribes or something and give information out. I was like, oh, okay, I can understand what you're saying, but I'm not that type of person, but I understand. So. Yeah, that killed me for doing anything there. Credit kept me out. So I can understand. I can relate in little and things like that that they can keep you out of certain things.
They can. And everyone heard that when I said it was my eyesight. Everyone's like, well, get LASIK. Oh, my God, get LASIK and you'll be fine. And the problem is my astigmatism is so bad that I'm actually outside the safety standards to get it fixed. Like, my eye doctor sits on the board for the state of, like, LASIK requirements and safety standards, and he's like there might be a doctor who'd be willing to try,
but you don't want to hear that.
He's like, but ethically I would not recommend it. You would still have a lot of the side effects. You'd still have to wear glasses. He's like, I honestly just don't think it's worth it. But I did find some solace in the fact that it was out of my control. The reason I failed out wasn't because something I could have done differently.
Right.
So I was able to kind of move on from there and be like, all right, so there goes my career plan for the next like 20, 30 years. Well, I'm dispatching and I like it. So I guess I'll just stick with this.
Yeah. And at the risk of sounding cliche, things happen for a reason.
They do,
you know?
They 100%.
So then, you get into the center that you're at, and how does that start out for you? Because you technically had a lot of experience already.
Yes, I did. So in comparison to the incident that I handle that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
As a trainee, I mean, it's to go from a smaller town to Boston.
Right.
Boston's such a beast. Everything is split up. You're either a 911 call taker or you're a police dispatcher.
Okay.
And you only do one or the other because it's so busy. If you're a dispatcher, you're busy. It's not like you're sitting waiting for the calls to come in. They're coming. You're triaging. You're looking through the calls and figuring out what's the priority. What am I getting out?
Right.
So as a trainee, what I had a hard time was they do a lot of, there's a lot of high speed traffic, foot pursuits, car pursuits, shootings, people getting stabbed. And a lot of the units that handle that are more like the specialized units. So as a trainee, you're not just trying to get to know, well, a handful of voices. It is dozens and dozens and dozens of voices. And so I remember one incident as a trainee handling a foot pursuit and being so bad at it that the sergeant called our supervisors and was like, I don't know who that is off the air, but get her off. And I remember the supervisor coming down, and the supervisor was known for being a dick.
Yeah.
Point blank.
Yeah.
And was like, this is awful. You're going to have to be completely retrained. I mean, he dressed me down in front of everyone. I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. I'm mortified. I'm completely mortified. But I actually had a coworker who saw that I was kind of getting upset and like beating myself up about it. And he was like, Hey, listen, that supervisor's a dick.
Yeah.
Next time he gets in your face, you ask him why he's here.
There's always a story.
And he told me very specifically why that supervisor was here. And it was why the supervisor was kind of banned to dispatch to supervise and not out on the street. And it was a doozy of a story. And it made me smile.
Yeah.
And it made me, you know, pick myself back up and, okay, well, I can do this. And I think that's kind of the drive I have as I see, like, okay, I'm struggling with something. Well, now I want to, like, tackle it 100 times more just to get better at it, to, like, you know, dominate it. But so that was my introduction to Boston. Was, I don't know who that is, but get her off the chair.
Well, so did you, have you always been police dispatch, or have you done call taking as well then there?
For Boston, I just dispatched. Other agencies, I've done call taking. I've dispatched police, fire, EMS. I've done EMD.
Yeah.
But Boston, because of its setup, I just dispatched.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you've been doing that for how many years then?
I've been in 911 for 12 years. Yeah.
Nice. Do you remember your first 911 call at all from your previous agency?
From when I first started?
Yeah.
I do.
Oh, right.
Oh, my God. I do. I remember that phone ringing and picking it up, and it was someone in a hotel whose family member had just gotten released from the hospital, and they had, like, a trach or something.
Yeah.
Something set up. But whatever it was, they were having issues, and they had stopped breathing. And the call came in, complete and utter chaos. I think they sounded like they were religious, so it was the man talking into the phone saying, mm-hmm. this is what's going on.
Right.
And there was screaming in the background, like screaming and like praying, but in a different language. So yeah. It was just like, and it was chaotic. And the ambulance actually happened to be like right there. So they got in right before I could even start going into EMD. Mm-hmm. And then I literally hung up the phone and the phone rang right again. So now this is my second call, back to the first. And it's state police. And they're like, ma'am, this is state police. We have a transfer on the line. The husband's with his wife and she's in labor on the side of the road. And I'm like, are you shitting me? This is really like the like shit magnet right away, right?
Right.
We all know like there are people out
you're
there
the
that
shmagnet.
Are shit magnet. I'm a shmagnet from day one. And the guy in comparison, it was 180 degrees from that first call. First call, complete chaos. Second call, yeah, hi, my wife's in labor and I'm starting to talk him through delivery.
Yeah.
And he's like, yep, she's in labor and yep, oh look, the head and oh, there it is. And that was literally it. That was it. And then state police was there and I was done.
Did you get a stork pin for that?
I did not.
Oh man.
I didn't, to be fair. It sounds like the baby just kind of popped out. I don't know. I've never had kids. I've never had to help anyone with childbirth, but
yeah.
it sounded like things were already pretty underway. And and he just was like, but very, very stoic.
The entire
time. Just, oh, yeah, my wife's in labor. Oh, there it is.
Dang. Yeah, it's completely different. I can imagine you going from the one call to this next one, hearing that. And like you said, are you shitting me?
Yeah.
And then as it's going on, you're like, Oh, okay. We got it. This is fine.
Yeah. I hung up and I prayed to God that phone didn't ring a third time because I was like, I don't know what I'm going to get, but I don't want it.
So then how big was that agency then? How many people worked at the same time? Was it just you on a shift or was there a couple other people with you?
That first agency I worked with?
Yeah, that first one. Those calls came
through. There were 3 to 4 of us.
Okay.
3 to 4 of us. Yeah. And it was pretty split up. So you had 2 people, police dispatching.
Uh-huh.
One person dispatching fire, and then one person kind of clerking and call taking. So that's, and as the new person, that's what I was doing. I was doing the call taking.
Nice.
Yeah.
Oh man. So then you make your transition over to Boston.
Yeah.
And what is your training like then on just police dispatch? Like, how does it work? Like, I remember my training doing main radio and doing police dispatch, but it was the county that I worked for. Nowhere near the call volume that you worked with. So I mean, I can just imagine it's pretty much the same, but just the traffic just being
nuts. You get assigned to a dispatcher and, you know, different agencies have different setups as to how you hear and transmit on the radio.
Yeah.
Boston, you wear headsets. You have to. There's so many channels
right
on. So you wear a headset. So as a trainee, you also wear a headset and you can mute it and you listen in to your trainer as they dispatch. And they'll explain, well, this is how this channel operates. These are the standard calls we get. This is, you know, certain things happen at certain times.
Right.
And you basically just shadow. You do go over policies and stuff kind of that first couple days with the head trainer. But then you're just on the floor, and that is your training. It's just on the floor.
It's kind of like when I very first started dispatching in Central Florida, and I went in, and my trainer took a 911 call. I watched him, and then he goes, okay, you're next. And I thought he was kidding. I thought he was bullshitting, and he was dead serious. And I remember him telling me, the only way you're going to learn how to do this is by getting in there.
Yeah.
You learn on the job. Yeah. So the same with you. You're listening and you're learning. And then how many months?
I had one trainer take away my pad of paper and pen.
Oh.
The channel I ended up on during these incidents and things, she was like, this channel moves so fast, you don't have time.
Right, because there's no way you're going to have time to write it down.
Because you can't keep up, because you have to, so she, like, I had to learn how to, like, just memorize.
Right.
Every bit
no
of
time
information
to, no time
I
to hit
needed.
That playback.
but it was important. Yeah, right. Like, you don't have time in a critical incident to hit playback.
Right.
So it really was drawing on mentally. My memory for that incident just had to be spot on. But it was helpful because then you these incidents where they're like, ma'am, what were the boundaries for this crime scene? And you can just spit right back what it was because you're not like, oh, wait, let me grab my notes. It's there.
Right.
So it almost, it really was probably the best thing she could have done because it's what allowed me to be able to handle that channel on my own later on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. The paper and all is like a crutch.
Yeah.
It's holding you back.
Yeah.
You got to let go of that crutch in order to heal. So and keep moving. So, yeah, no, for real. That's, man. That kind of makes my anxiety go up a little bit. Just kind of thinking about it. That's nuts. But that's also amazing that, you know, you had someone to actually push you, because sometimes and not all people are like this, not all agencies are like this, but there are some trainers that and they say, you know, you eat your young, or we eat our young, or whatever.
We do.
And sometimes
100%.
People will just let you go. It's like, why didn't you tell me that before? Well, you got to learn. Like, well, I understand I've got to learn, but you could help me out a little bit too.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not taking your job. We're supposed to be here working together.
Yeah.
We're a team, you know? So it's cool that they took that from you. And you're like, look, going to be real with you and up front.
Yes.
You got to get rid of this shit so that you can keep up. So then I guess going from that, you know, segueing into some of the big calls, because so we've talked about your first call. I usually ask if there's a call that has stuck with you. And there are two big incidents that you've dealt with. One specifically that we're going to be talking about, that you're going to be sharing here in front of the attendees of this Critical Issues Forum.
Yes.
And I don't mean to say it that way until I feel like you're going to be doing this big ass thing. I mean, it is
big.
Actually what you're going to be
it
doing.
But yeah.
But it's a good thing. You're sharing your story. You're getting it out there. And people are going to learn. And they're going to be able to relate to you from it. Now, the first thing I want to hit on, because you were there, you were in the room, you experienced it. And it's also, I don't think, one that we've shared on this as well. And this is the Boston Marathon bombing. So so you were there. I mean, you experienced a lot of the stuff that was going on. Kind of touch on that a little bit.
Yeah, that was a weird day. It's you know, Boston, we always have different incidents and things going on where they open up the extra channel. And I walked into work that day knowing, oh, the marathon's going on, so we'll have that extra channel open up. There'll probably be more brass around because of it, because they had the situation room open. But I remember walking in, and I was early. I walked in the building around 3. And walked in, and someone's like, oh, someone's got going on, you know, something's going on.
Right.
And I was like, well, what is it? And they're like, I don't know, it sounds like an officer in trouble. No T, we call it. And I remember thinking, okay, well, sounds like it's going to be a day. Let me go eat my lunch now.
Right, because you're not going to get a chance to.
Let me eat some food.
Yeah.
And I walked into the break room, which has a TV going on, and I'm sitting there eating my sandwich, and I look up, and they all of a sudden switch over to... you know, something's happening at the marathon site. And I just remember thinking, oh God, let me get in there. And I walked onto the floor, and it I think even at that time we weren't sure what happened, except, well, there was some kind of explosion.
Wow.
And I remember checking in with the supervisor like we do before every shift. And they were like, well, you're going to be on this channel today. And they were like, just go plug in, just see who needs help. And one of the people on that incident channel was worried about family members. And I remember seeing she was trying to dispatch, but also trying to check her phone for messages from family. And I remember just plugging in my headset and saying, go take care, like, go check on your family. I'll take over here. And that had to have been around 20 after 3, so a few minutes right after the incident. And I plugged in, and it was just utter chaos.
Jeez.
It was just chaos. You know, everyone's screaming, everyone's trying to get on the radio. And the rest of that day was pretty surreal, I think, is a good way to,
right.
is yeah. a good way to explain it. It yeah. was surreal. It was, oh my God, we just had a bomb. We had two bombs go off. And the channel I was on was the bomb squads coordinating, finding other bombs. Jeez. Anything unattended that day in the city got a response from the bomb squad. And that literally, like, I have notes. I've got like legal pad pages
right.
at home filed away somewhere. All my notes from that week. And it's chicken. I mean, it's chicken scratch. It's not, it's right. nothing well written.
As most of us do when we're, historical when we're writing sake. Notes. Yeah.
yeah, it was just random call signs and locations and different things. And,
yeah.
You know, a lot of people, at one point, there was an explosion over at UMass Boston. And I remember thinking, oh my God, they're everywhere. Whoever's setting these bombs are, it's all around the city.
Yeah.
And it ended up being it was a transformer explosion, completely unrelated.
Yeah.
But it just, that heightened sense of, oh God, what is happening in our city right now? So I was there, the next day I was there for 16 hours. I took my 2 days off in the middle of that week. Mm-hmm. I was feeling pretty tense. I do some photography on the side. I was like, I actually want to go down and see the site for myself. I want to walk the perimeter. I want to take some pictures. I want to, you know, the last 2 days that I've spent immersed, I want to kind of put a picture to it.
Yeah.
So I walked down, but primarily I stayed away from media. I had a friend at one point, I don't know if many people remember this, but at one point people had thought, well, they caught him and they're bringing him to the courthouse. And then the courthouse got a bomb threat. And they hadn't caught him. It was a rumor.
Yeah.
But my friend who works in law enforcement texted me and said, I think they have him. And I remember thinking, oh, okay, well, it's over. And I didn't pay attention to social media for the next 2 days until Friday morning when I was due in for a double shift at 7 a.m. And I opened up my Facebook page and thought, oh, fuck, because there had been the manhunt. Because Sean Collier had been shot, because Watertown was now shut down.
Yeah.
The city, Boston, was shut down. Everything was shut down, and there was a manhunt underway. And I, driving to work that morning was the eeriest thing, because I drive, people who are listening to this who know Boston, know Mass and Cass, right? Methadone Row. And I drive through that to get to work, and it was a ghost town. It was the weirdest feeling ever to be driving through the city. Jeez. And everything is shut down. And we get to work and they had put concrete barriers up around headquarters because it's a building, a federal building. And we had to walk through those concrete barriers in order to get into work. And I sat on the channel that day, me and a coworker were paired up on that channel. And I sat on that channel and we had people, I mean, there were some coworkers, there's some dedicated people up there in Boston. We had people on vacation who came in on vacation to work those channels, to work the overtime, to be a part of it. And those are the voices you hear when you listen to the recordings.
Right.
And, but towards the end of that night, they caught him. And it was the most surreal feeling. At the beginning of this week, I was listening to these explosions go off. And now I'm listening to these people saying, hey, we have the suspect. We caught him in the boat.
Oh, man.
So it was a week.
It's crazy.
It was a week.
It's crazy to hear you piece all of this together, because I remember watching all of it. I remember the moment that they caught him. But to hear it from you, you know, being there, that just, it's mind blowing. And I can't imagine, you know, just the way you're saying, I mean, it's just surreal. It's just.
Yeah. And I that's the thing. Like, I was there. I was in the room. I happened to be partnered with people on that channel.
Yeah.
But you won't hear my voice a lot. I was kind of the backup. I was, you know, assisting whoever was really running the channel. I was there taking notes, handling phone calls, communicating to others what was going on, kind of filling in on breaks and different things, too. But the people that you hear, I mean, they're the ones who got to answer that call. You know, yeah, SWAT commander, go ahead. We got him. So it was an incredible week. I can't deny I don't have pretty strong feelings about it. I remember we went to Vegas that year.
Yeah.
And Rolling Stone did a feature story on Tarzanov. where he was the front picture. He was the front cover.
Yeah.
And we were in Vegas. We were in line for a Gordon Ramsay restaurant somewhere. And I remember being so pissed that they would do that. That my husband, like, people were, like, not looking. You know, like, I wasn't causing a scene, but I was talking to my husband. And I was like, I can't believe they would do that. That fucking piece of shit.
Right.
What he did. And to this day, I don't, like, I've walked down Boylston many a time. But when it actually comes to the marathon day, I want nothing to do with it.
I can imagine.
I want nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
So I'm happy to see that it continues to be a day of celebration, largely. There's a lot of people I know. I know now a lot of athletes who are very much dedicated to it. And I think it's really admirable that people are able to set aside that fear. But for me, it's just something. I just remember the audio. I remember what the other first responders went through that day, and it's hard to get into that celebratory feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I can fully see why you, and I was going to ask you too, you know, when they ended up saying we caught him, was there a moment in there where it was a celebration or just a sigh of relief, or was it silent? I mean,
dispatchers aren't silent.
Oh, yeah. That's why I was wondering, because, you know, everyone is different.
They said we caught him, and we were like, we caught him, and everyone clapped and cheered. I remember looking over, and one person was wiping their eyes.
Yeah.
And, it was a very emotional event. It really was. And I think back to that week, and I know, you know, look, dispatch centers, everyone has politics. Everyone has feuds. There's always crap, right? We're a dysfunctional family. But I remember that week, people were pretty, there was a lot of solidarity that week. And I think in that moment when we were all cheering and clapping that he was caught was really, you know, we were unified.
Yeah.
Just for a moment.
That's awesome.
Just for a moment.
That is a good, good feeling. I can feel that energy from you. That's awesome. Now, so that was that incident.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you've got this other incident that you were on radios. And it's an incident that's part of your presentation that you're going to be giving today at the Critical Issues Forum. And first and foremost, thank you very much for sharing that story about the Boston Marathon and everything. And especially this one as well that we're going to be talking about. Kind of give me just a little bit of the beginning of what this incident is about, and then we'll go from there.
So the incident I handled was an officer-involved shooting.
Mm-hmm.
It was basically a traffic stop gone wrong, very wrong. And that's what I handled. And the presentation, it's not so much about, well, the incident that I handled. The presentation is really more about what the fallout was, what the aftermath was of that. Of how I struggled to cope with my body's response to that stress.
So what we're going to do right now is we're going to actually listen to that audio. So I want to warn all of you who are listening right now, we're going to hear something that is, you can fast forward it if you want, but it is graphic. You're going to hear stuff that you don't usually hear. So I'm going to go ahead and play this again. I just wanted to warn you, if you, you know, at any time at all, if you have any suicidal tendencies or have PTSD, this could be a trigger, which you're about to hear. So we're going to go ahead and play this. It's about 13 minutes long, and then we're going to come back into it.
Bravo 909. 9-9, go ahead.
Sam, I don't care if you have to do whatever you have to do to get any ambulance up there forthwith.
Absolutely.
We're responding.
One person shot.
Okay, you guys have one person shot. What's the wound?
We need an agent here right now. We have an officer down and one suspect down. The ambulance is coming by Gale Street right now.
Okay, guys, the ambulance is
coming. Come on down.
He's passing on. He's up by MLK right now off of Walnut.
That's the description, guys.
Keep Humboldt clear.
Units, keep Humboldt clear. What's the description?
Suspect is down. Everyone's in custody. We need Agent H as an officer right now.
Sir, Agent H is on the way. You have EMS on the way, sir.
Bravo 909.
9-9, go ahead.
And as soon as the ambulance arrives, I want them escorted to the hospital. I want two units with that ambulance.
Yeah, Bravo 412, Bravo 434. Follow the ambulance to the hospital.
Guys,
watch your mics. Watch your mics. You have units in the room.
6-6-K. 6-6-K. I got the unit for your truck. On you. 6-6-K-9-8. Do we have a police officer shot there?
Yes, we do. We need those cruisers to stay on one side of the road so the ambulance can get through, guys.
Okay, guys, keep on both that clear. Victor K980, you have that, sir.
Guys, stay clear so the ambulance can come in. Stay clear of the street.
Sergeant Braga, go up to 13. Go up to 13.
Bravo 434, you have that assignment.
EMS in here now.
EMS is on scene, I have it, ma'am.
Yeah, 980, I'm in route to that location.
980, I have it.
What's the location?
Humboldt and
Rootsman and Humboldt. Rootsman and Humboldt. Yankee Bravo 4, let us know what hospital they're taking the officer to.
Thank you, Bravo 4, I have it.
Bravo 909.
99.
Ma'am, let's get him in the ambulance and get him moving, please.
Units, just watch the traffic on Humboldt, let EMS get through.
Yankee C2 on the way.
Yankee C2
on the way.
Go ahead, sir.
We're at the top of Humboldt to see, but let us know which way that ambulance needs to go so we can clear a path.
Okay,
we have 412. They're probably going to go up Humboldt towards Siva.
Okay, we'll notify Jake units.
Shut down Humboldt on all sides. Get the traffic off of Humboldt.
Bravo 99, I have that. Jake units are going to take care of Seaver to clear the route for EMS. Bravo unit, shut down Humboldt Ave, please.
Are we going to clear Shaw going up Humboldt towards Seaver?
Victor 905.
Victor 905, go ahead, sir.
Take me off to that Humboldt and Wilson.
I have it, sir.
Bravo 980.
Bravo 980, go ahead.
I have a police officer shot. He's in the ambulance. He's going to be going to the hospital. I'll get that for you in a minute. I got the Bravo 412 going with the ambulance. Copy?
412 going with the EMS, have it.
Like that. Let's make room to get the ambulance out of here, and let's shut down Humboldt Ave, all right?
Okay, guys. Humboldt Ave's going to be shut down.
Bravo 909.
Bravo 99, go ahead.
The ambulance is loaded. We're bringing them right up Humboldt right now.
Going up Humboldt, I have it.
It's Charlie 810 in Eggleston Square. Just let me know when you're close.
810, I have it.
Let's go, guys.
60K 980,
go ahead. The gang is supervised right here. We are the scene right now, controlled.
Scene is controlled, sir. Sir, where is the officer going?
412, I'll let you know, ma'am. They're still working on him.
412, I have it, sir. Let me know what route we can get units to make a clear route for them.
I will.
12, I have it.
Get the K-980,
go ahead.
We need EMS, second EMS to Humboldt Ruppin. We have a suspect shot as well.
Okay, I have it, sir.
Take the K-680, 207 Humboldt.
207 Humboldt for the suspect, I have it.
Okay, we have EMT here.
We have cruisers waiting for the ambulance to escort them to the hospital at top of Humboldt.
4-3.
Bravo, 909.
9, go ahead.
The ambulance is just about to move. As soon as it moves, we got to strap this scene down. The scene needs to be shut.
Scene needs to be shut down once the EMS moves and units be advised. State is going to be clearing a path for us.
Piston, stop traffic speeding into Humboldt.
Thank you, Bravo 4. Have the ambulance come up Humboldt to Shiva. We have everything shut down all the way to the hospital. Captain, we're moving right now.
Watch your mic.
Yankee Bravo 4,
you have the air.
Yeah, Humboldt to Shiva, and we're going to go all the way to Boston Medical. Humboldt to Shiva to Boston Medical.
Humboldt to Shiva to BMC, sir. We have Jake units and state police assisting.
909, we're moving right now.
EMS is moving.
Sir, you're going Wash down to Dudley, correct? Over to Melmia.
Gets to
Seaver,
I want a car to
lead it. You got to watch your mic. Yes, you're
stepping on it.
I got three units talking at once. Bravo 99. Do we know what path they're going?
We're going to Boston Medical.
Take the K980.
Okay. Just, I know this is crazy. The ambulance with the officer is outbound on Humboldt now. We have a suspect who I believe is going to stay here. He's been declared. We have three other officers that need minor medical attention at this point. And can you notify the BPPA reps to respond as well, please?
Okay, I have that, sir.
Yankee C1, can you take me off there, please?
Yankee C1, I have it.
980, 50K 980.
Guys, watch your mic.
I'm going to pass from District 4 at City Hospital. Stand by for security for that officer as well, okay?
Sir, I will get those units from D4 for security. Victor K 980, you have the air.
Victor K 14, can I have the air for 1 second? I'm trying to locate Tom Bernier. There was a kid running in this area that he was behind.
Bernier is accounted for. He's in with the officer, Michael.
Okay, Victor K-14, we have all units accounted for at this time. Victor K-14.
All your side streets as you're en route.
Okay, I have a Victor K-14.
810, the ambulance is approaching Demick Street.
I have that. Those Victor units who were off, can we just make sure everyone is accounted for at this time?
You got all available detectives responding down there?
ma'am. Could we have a route on that ambulance, please? We're crossing over Ritchie Street in Columbus.
Okay, crossing Columbus and Wayne Street. You got stepped on.
We're coming up to RCC. Coming up to RCC.
What hospital is that officer going to?
BMC, sir.
Predict the K-902. We have additional ambulances coming for three other officers for minor injuries, correct?
Yes, sir.
Bravo 901.
91, go ahead.
Cross Street for the Delta units.
They're stepping on each other. 91, go ahead.
901, ma'am, go ahead and activate citywide EDT.
Citywide EDT, sir, I have it. You need supervisor?
Yes, ma'am.
10936, let me see you on my bike. You're Humboldt Crawford.
Predict the K-902. One second, the ambulance to these three officers. We need officers to go with each of these officers to the hospital.
K-92, I have that, sir.
Tango 631.
Ma'am, show me on scene here for
Patrolman's
location. 631, you're on scene. I have it, sir.
Yankee Charlie 24 on scene.
Go on. Yankee Charlie 24, you're also on scene. That other unit, go ahead.
Yeah, Victor K-901, ma'am. We're going to have an ambulance up here to transport an officer to the hospital.
I have it, sir. My supervisors have it. We're getting them right up there, and we'll get units to follow them as well.
Location for the Delta units so they know which streets to block.
Last unit, you got stepped on.
Looks like we're going to come up Albany from Molina Cass.
Albany from Cass, I have it.
So we just listened to this audio, and I was telling you earlier, too, I was trying to listen to this, and I ended up having to do some work really quick. I got a phone call, and then I jumped right back into it, knowing exactly what I was going to listen to, and because I've dealt with a similar situation a couple times, it still doesn't get easier. If that makes sense,
it
doesn't make it easier listening to something like this because you hear the officer scream out, "Shots fired." And that's something that you never want to hear. And as I was sitting there in my room listening, and I've got my hand over my mouth, the hair on the back of my neck is standing up, and I'm in the zone. Like I'm right back in there, you know, just putting myself in your shoes. And I have to say right off the bat, and I said this to you already before, you did an amazing job. Like you were very calm and very much in control of this call. I mean, everyone is talking back to you and they're following what you're saying. And it's an awesome situation in the midst of chaos of what this is. And people who are listening to it in the general public, how is that an awesome, you know, thing? Well, I say awesome because of the obvious camaraderie there between the officers that are out in the field and you in there in control on the radio. So that's why I say that. So I guess after listening to that audio and everything, and especially you experiencing it, what is going through your head during that time? You know, because again, you're very calm, cool, and collected. But you yourself told me, you know, you sometimes, like, we are our worst critics.
Yeah.
And you didn't feel like you did. You know, there was at one point, you know, you were saying that you felt like you messed up maybe. But listening to it, I don't know where you would have, because it was, you did an excellent job. So
thank you.
Take me through that moment.
So probably the most foremost thought in my head was, don't fuck this up.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Oh God, Nicole, don't fuck this up. No, it was an instant like, oh God. All right. And that, you know, that channel that shooting happened on is a very busy channel. There's shootings all the time. There's foot pursuits all the time. There's car pursuits. It's definitely, I was not any stranger to people cutting in with something, okay, I'm dropping everything else and this is, okay, we're going, this is it.
Right.
So the shootings, the stabbings, foot pursuits, things like that, it's a busy channel and you get used to, okay, and you kind of just fall into, okay, well, what's the protocol? And yeah, we'll get the ambulance here. What's the wound? That was a common question. Okay, there's a suspect. What's the direction? What's the description? So we'll redirect units to go hunt the suspect down. You hear me? I'm following protocol. I'm asking questions. But I can tell something is off. I can tell from the emotions in their voice that something is different. And you hear them come through and say, we do have an officer down. And, you know, initially my thought when I had first went back and listened to the recording after it was all said and done was, I hate the gaps. There's gaps. And that's just more because it's scanner land.
Yeah, right.
But to me, as a dispatcher, I hear the gaps and I cringe because I thought, I hesitated. I don't remember hesitating, but it sounds like I hesitate. Mm-hmm. And I hated that. I hated that. So much so that I apologized to the units who were there that day. I got to meet them a few days after. And that was the first thing I said was, I am so sorry for hesitating. I hate those gaps. And there was a female officer there, and she spoke up and she's like, no, you didn't. You didn't hesitate. You were always right there with us. You were right there. There was never a moment where we needed something and you were not there. And that really, and the aftermath that came, my own stress, those were really encouraging words. It really helped ease me. I couldn't listen to the recording a lot because those initial shots fired, just stuck with me. But at least I could listen and not cringe as much,
right,
knowing that, okay, well, that's the recording. It's not me hesitating. The incident itself moves very fast. I cannot believe, I know it's like a 15-minute clip. It does not feel like 15 minutes. I can't believe all of that happened in 15 minutes. It feels like it happened in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And the interesting thing is, you know, we as dispatchers know, well, they're dealing with their own stuff out on the field, but you know, an incident like that happens and what happens to your station, right? Everybody wants to come over. Supervisors are right over your shoulder. You've got coworkers still trying to talk to you about stuff.
Yeah.
Everyone knows what's up. And yet life is still going on as we know it for dispatchers. So it's my multitasking for that shift went to a level that I don't think I have ever experienced since. Maybe once, and that was when I worked by myself during a blizzard, and we ended up having a 2-alarm fire. But my multitasking floor, having to answer the phone, talk with supervisors, direct coworkers, handle radio traffic, I mean, it was just nuts. And at the same time, I was so laser focused that I knew like everything was crystal clear.
Right.
Yeah. It was a very weird, surreal feeling. It took a while to hit that this was an officer. Because in my mind, right, and in my professional mindset, just a shooting.
Yeah.
Just another shooting. Even when they had said, well, we have an officer down and this is what's going on. Okay, it's just a shooting. All right, we got the crime scene. All right, well, protesters showed up. All right, we'll get additional units to handle the protesters. And I don't think it was till I went home that I realized just how much I was still on edge.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you go through this incident. Was there an immediate debriefing? And when I say immediate, I mean more like within a day, or did it happen that day?
No, so that's kind of interesting. You know, I found out years later, coming back into the field and reconnecting with people, I found out some kind of interesting things. I remember having a couple of coworkers say to me that night, hey, if you need help with this, they have like a peer support unit. Reach out to the peer support unit. And they actually said, they went up and told the supervisors, hey, we should get the peer support unit called for her to get a debriefing, to get help of some kind. No one ever reached out. I ended up 2 days later saying, hey, I need some help. And I reached out on my own accord. But initially, no, there was never any offer for a debriefing. The other interesting thing that I was told was a coworker said at one point, and this is well into the incident, why is she still on that channel? Why is she still dispatching? She should be pulled off and given, you know, incident's done.
Right.
She needs to get pulled. And the supervisor said, she's just a civilian. She's doing fine.
What?
And that's the mindset of what I was working in. So, yeah, everyone said I did a great job. Like I said, worst critic. And an officer got shot. And
how long did this incident happen? How long ago?
Almost 5 years. It'll be 5 years this March.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I remember coming into work next day, same shift, same channel, same radio traffic, and just sitting down and dispatching and doing everything. A bunch of people, hey, congratulations. The chief came up. Hey, I want to say thank you. The commissioner thanks you. Everyone's thanking me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't really know why. I don't know why. It hadn't hit me. But I'm just here to do my job. And the thing that was different in all of it was I could not get that audio out of my head. That audio of them screaming just kept playing and playing and playing. And it wasn't until I went home that night. And it finally, I think, just all hit me. I don't know if I was in shock or just, you know, work mind, work mode, compartmentalize, right?
Yeah.
Leave your emotions at the door. But I went home that night and I remember saying to my husband, I don't want to think anymore. I want to shut my brain off. I can't think about this anymore. And I proceeded to get very blackout drunk,
mm-hmm.
extremely drunk. And I think I went probably to some dark places that night. There's honestly a lot of that night I don't remember, but there are some that I do. And that's all, you know, thanks to Jim and Jack. But I remember waking up the next morning and being terrified that's what my response was, because I have alcoholism in my family.
Mm-hmm.
My biological mother was a severe alcoholic. So much so that I ended up in foster care because of it. And so I've always been very hyper aware of my own alcohol use.
Right.
And when I saw that was the direction I went to deal with my stress, I was terrified. And that's where I reached out. I called into the supervisor's desk and said, hey, I had a really rough night. I would like to speak to someone. And I remember this particular supervisor was very gentle. And she's like, yeah, is it finally kind of hitting you? And I was like, it is. And she's like, all right, well, we'll reach out to our peer support unit. And they did. They called back. And I don't think they meant anything malicious by it. They were just trying to explain their stance. But they said to me, we don't normally deal with civilians. We're making an exception for you. And I remember thinking, somewhat, I was humiliated.
Yeah.
About... Well, I reached out for help, and now I feel like I'm just an inconvenience.
Right.
You know, like, yeah. Oh, God.
We're making an exception.
You're making an exception.
Thanks.
And I kind of just got the sense, okay, well, this is CYA, right? Because you can't have someone say, well, I need help, but then not do anything because
right.
then it's a liability.
Exactly.
And so I did meet with them. A lot of it is right. They're all cops, different mindset, different job. So I did get to talk about, you know, we'll eat well and physical activity, and if you feel stressed, the general talk.
Yeah.
And they did arrange for me to meet with those officers, those special units that responded, and that was a big help as well to be able to meet them. But I remember walking away and they had said, well, basically our goal is to get you to feel better so you can go back to doing your job. And I remember that kind of scared me because I thought, well, I'm still doing my job. It's not like I've left.
Yeah.
Still doing my job. But what if I don't get better? What if I'm really stressed? And I had that frustration of, I don't think they understand how I'm, excuse me, how I'm feeling right now.
Yeah.
Now,
these people that you were talking to, Were they just straight up counselors? Were they counselors that come from public safety at all, or
no? It's a specialized unit with the police department, mm-hmm. And they're there to be there for their brothers and sisters in uniform who go through these incidents. You know, to do the debriefings, to do the counseling, to counsel them on stress. So I'm not knocking what they're doing. But I don't know that they were equipped at the time to deal with civilians. First of all, to even recognize that civilians can have the same reactions, just because we don't see it, right, doesn't mean we're not going to have the same response. We still have to hear it.
Exactly.
And listen to it.
Right. And sometimes the imagination is worse than what the incident is.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Because we have to piece it all from what we're listening to.
We do. And we often think worst case scenario. So we fill it in worst case scenario.
Of course.
So I think it was... You know, they wanted to help, but at the same time, completely different perspective, completely different job,
yeah,
type of thing.
And the reason I asked that is because there was one time specifically with some coworkers of mine and I, we asked for help as well, and they brought someone in to talk to us. But the first thing the gentleman says is, so what happened, you know, and we tell him, and then he says, well, how does it make you feel?
Yeah.
That's not okay. Yeah.
Yep.
I was like, do you have room for us to all lay down and start drinking us? It's not what we thought this was going to happen.
But I think too,
but he didn't understand.
That's why I'm excited too, to kind of share my story. And like I said, I'm including some of the IM911 stories as well too, because
right,
as much as yes, what I went through, was, I don't want to say horrific, but it was definitely a big battle. It broke me. Mm-hmm. It completely broke me. I know there's others like there, just like that. And I, as much as, yes, this peer support program was trying to help, you know, we're really at the point with our profession where we need to start taking care of ourselves. We need to have those resources available for us from other people who know what we're actually going through. It's great. Yes, that we can have resources we can pull in from the outside to be able to have some sort of help. But ideally, getting peer support programs in place and critical incident stress management teams that have dispatchers that are able to respond and debrief other dispatchers.
Yes.
That's a much more powerful tool. You know, if I'm able to talk to someone, well, hey, I had an officer involved shooting and I couldn't deal with it. The response is going to vary depending on who I'm talking to. If I'm talking to a cop, I'm talking to another dispatcher.
Right.
Who gets what it's like to have to sit in that chair and listen to it all.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It definitely means a lot more when you're speaking to somebody and they know exactly where you're coming from. I think that's one of the reasons, too, that the Imagine Listening session that I do works so well, because all of us who are in there, we all come from the same place.
Yeah.
And I tell them, like, that the whole point of this is to share your stories and to get it out there. Even if you don't want to share one, you're there for that person, mm-hmm, so that they know they're not alone. And that's what all of this is for. And then it's an actual recorded episode with this live audience, and then others hear it, and people will send in messages saying, I thought I was the only one, but I've heard all of these stories.
Yeah.
So you're right on the money there, yeah, with it, you know, being completely different, hearing it from another dispatcher versus another officer or firefighter or what have you, whatever.
Yeah.
So I'm very excited for your session. Mm. I know you're going to do amazing. This has been just a huge, great story. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing this. As we go into the wrap up of this episode, what is it that you want the attendees of your session to get out of this? And I guess, because it sounds like you've got a mission here as well.
I do.
What is your mission to go along with this story that you're sharing?
Well, I mean. The mission of sharing it, you know, the story is about, yes, how I handled this critical incident, how I was really impacted by PTSD, so much so that I completely left 911. Mm-hmm. I walked away from a career that I loved, at a job that I loved, because ultimately I felt like mentally I have to take care of myself and I don't have the support I need right now.
Yeah.
From my employer. I don't know where to go. But I know right now this job is killing me, and I am a liability, and I don't want to be that dispatcher on the front page, because I caused someone to get killed. So I left 911 completely. And what I talk about in my presentation is how I was able to kind of change my perspective, how my mindset changed as I had time away to de-stress, to breathe, right? Just to breathe, to not dispatch. But how I was eventually given tools that kind of empowered me to be able to come back. And I told myself, if I come back, that I would advocate, that I would be a voice for, hey, we need these services too. Because that's what I heard while I was gone, you know, a little too late, because I'd already left, was what happened to you wasn't right and you should have had support while you went through all of that.
Yeah.
What happened wasn't right. And so I kind of came back with this fire of, well, let's make it right. Let's make it right. And I came back about a year and a half after being gone and was pleasantly surprised to see that the conversation was already starting to change, that other people were recognizing we need peer support too. We need awareness of self-care and wellness initiatives. We need to be involved in these debriefings because, look, our career is already a shit show, right? Turnover is incredible. You can hire five people and maybe two will make it through training. We're having a hard time filling the seats. And then on top of that, you have dedicated professionals who are capable of doing the job. And we're piling these incidents on them, but not giving them any support. And so we're losing even more people. But at least that could be preventable. That we have some kind of power to change, to get these resources out to people, to say what you're experiencing is normal. And that's really my mission, is let's normalize PTSD. Let's normalize and recognize that PTSD is a normal, your body's reaction to an incident. It's a fight or flight reaction to an incident. And that is perfectly normal. And what you need to then do is recognize it and figure out, well, how do I manage it? And that's my mission by sharing my story is to say, look, this is what I went through and it was hell.
Yeah.
It was fucking hell and I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And yet I know even as I'll be standing there talking that somewhere in that moment, a dispatcher is going to be picking up a phone and their life is going to change. And how are we going to be there for that dispatcher? So I saw something on social media that really was very powerful to me and really kind of, I think, sums up the mission wonderfully, and that is, you are not alone.
Yes.
Because as I went through my experience, I felt so isolated. I felt so alone in what I was going through. And that's a really shitty feeling when you're dealing with mental health stuff, to feel like no one else knows what I'm going through. And so since I've been back, that's been my mission, is you are not alone in this. We're not alone.
Yeah.
We're not. We're the thin gold line, right? We're exactly. All about, we're the thin gold line and we're part of this family. And it's really time that we step up and we be there for each other so we can try to change our profession for the better.
Perfect. Well, thank you again very much for being on this episode. Oh, and
thank you for having me.
I am I'm excited to be attending your session. And if you ever want to come on again, let's do this.
Sounds good.
Follow everything you're going to be doing.
All
so
right.
Thank you again so much for being on. For those who are listening, if you have any comments, questions, or you want to be a guest on the show, you can email us, and that'll be wttpodcast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter. That is @901podcast. You can like us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/withinthetrenchespodcast. I laugh because a mutual friend of ours, Tracy Elders, just passed by and stuck her tongue out at me. So this episode, as always, is supported by InDigital, a leader in next-gen core services. And a reminder again, we are on Patreon, so this podcast will always be free. But if you are looking for bonus content, free swag, discounts to the store on podcast merchandise, any stuff like that, if you're an industry partner and you're looking to partner up for a few things, check us out. And that is patreon.com/WTT podcast. This episode, as well as all the others, can be heard 24/7 on Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and your favorite podcasting app, as well as withinthetrenches.net. Have a good one, everybody.
You just listened to a Code 7 Network podcast. If you have any questions or would like to be a guest on the show, send an email to WTTpodcast@gmail.com.